The fog had come in thick off the water, the way it does in England that time of year. The kind of fog that turns a perfectly reasonable morning into something you can reach out and grab with your hand. Standing on a farm field outside Dover, staring at that gray wall in front of you, most people would have gone back inside, had another cup of tea, and waited for a better day. Harriet Quimby was not most people. I'm Taildragger. You're listening to The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're going back to April of 1912, to a story that got buried under one of the most famous disasters in human history, and that aviation still doesn't tell nearly enough. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, before we get to the Channel crossing, I want you to understand what aviation looked like in the summer of 1911. The Wright brothers had made their first flight just 8 years earlier. The aircraft being built and flown were flimsy, underpowered machines made of wood and fabric and wire held together with faith and a certain cheerful disregard for physics. The engines were unreliable on a good day. Navigation meant following a road or a river and hoping the weather held. Landing fields were any patch of ground flat enough that you didn't die on the rollout. Pilots were dying regularly. The newspapers covered it, the public followed it anyway because they couldn't help themselves. It was the most dangerous, most exciting, most genuinely new thing the world had ever seen, and people were obsessed with it. In that environment, a woman named Harriet Quimby walked into the Moissant Aviation School at Garden City, Long Island, and said she wanted to learn to fly. She was, by any measure, an impressive person before she ever touched an aircraft. She had been born in Michigan in 1875, and by the time she arrived in New York, she had built herself a career as a journalist and a drama critic for Leslie's Illustrated Weekly. This was one of the major publications of the era, the kind of magazine that sat on parlor tables in respectable homes across the country. She wrote well, she thought clearly, and she had a talent for explaining complicated things to people who hadn't encountered them before. She had also noticed, the way a certain kind of person notices things, that aviation was the story of the age, and that almost nobody in journalism was covering it from the inside, not from behind a fence at an air show. From inside the cockpit, she told almost nobody what she was doing at Garden City. She was a journalist. She understood what happened when a story got out before it was finished. She trained quietly and she trained seriously, and on August 1, 1911, she presented herself to the Aero Club of America for her pilot's examination. She flew the required maneuvers. She demonstrated control of the aircraft. She landed where she was supposed to land. The Aero Club issued her license number 37. She became the first American woman to hold a pilot certificate. The aviation press took notice. But Harriet Quimby was already thinking past that milestone. She had read the history closely enough to know what was still unclaimed. She knew that, in July of 1909, a Frenchman named Louis Blériot had done something that stunned the world. He had taken off from the coast of France in a small monoplane of his own design, pointed his nose at the gray sky, and flown across the English Channel to England. 21 miles of open water, 37 minutes in the air. A 25-horsepower engine, a compass. That was it. Britain had been an island since the last land bridge vanished, 10,000 years ago. The Channel had been their moat, their natural defense, the thing that kept Napoleon on his side of the water. Blériot crossed it in under 40 minutes, and the world understood immediately that geography had just changed. In the 3 years since that crossing, nobody had done it from the English side going to France, and no woman had ever flown it in either direction. Harriet Quimby made up her mind that she would be the first woman across, and she began arranging it with the kind of operational discipline that would have made a good airline dispatcher proud. She could not let word get out. The aviation world of 1912 was competitive, and it has to be said, not especially welcoming to women who wanted more than a passenger seat. If she announced her intention, she ran the risk of a male competitor making the crossing first just to take the record away from her, so she arranged it carefully and quietly. She got a connection to Gustav Hamel, a young English pilot who had flown the Channel route many times carrying mail between England and France. Hamel knew the weather patterns, the wind shifts, the way fog could build without warning over that 21 miles of cold gray water. He knew what could go wrong and how fast it could go wrong. He agreed to help her plan the attempt. And then he offered her a way out. Hamel told Quimby, with what she later described as genuine concern, that the Channel was too dangerous for someone who had never flown over open water. He laid out his reasoning, the fog, the winds, the impossibility of seeing the horizon when the sky and the sea merged into one gray nothing. He told her he didn't think she was prepared for what the crossing would actually demand, and then he proposed that he fly the Channel in her place. He would dress in her flying clothes.
He would take off from Dover, he would land in France. She would take the credit and the record, nobody would have to know. This was not a man trying to humiliate her. Everything we know about Hamill suggests he genuinely liked and admired Quimby. He believed the Channel crossing would kill her, and he was trying to find a way to get her the recognition without the risk. She told him no.
There's not much more to say about that exchange than the word no itself. She had not traveled to England in secret, arranged an aircraft, studied the route, and planned every detail of this operation in order to have someone else fly it for her. The point was not the record. The point was the crossing. She borrowed a two-seat Blériot 11 monoplane, fitted with a 70-horsepower Gnome rotary engine. If you've never seen a Gnome rotary, it is one of the more remarkable engines in aviation history. The entire engine, cylinders and all, rotates around a fixed crankshaft. The propeller is bolted directly to the engine. When it runs, the whole assembly spins. It sounds like nothing else in aviation, a sound somewhere between a mechanical hurricane and something you'd hear in a fever dream. It was unreliable, it was finicky, it threw castor oil everywhere, and it made the Blériot go. The aircraft itself was a thing of elegant simplicity. Monoplane configuration, wire-braced wings, a small tractor propeller up front, a wooden seat in the fuselage that offered almost no protection from the wind and weather. At altitude in April over the English Channel, the cold would cut through you like a blade. Harriet Quimby wore a purple satin flying suit that she had designed herself. It was hooded, it was practical, and it was distinctly hers. She wore goggles. She wore a life preserver. That last detail matters because it tells you something about how she thought. She was not reckless. She was prepared. There is a difference, and it is an important one. On the morning of April 16, 1912, she and her small team drove to Fermes-du-Forton, a farm field just outside Dover. The weather was exactly what you'd expect. Fog, gray sky, limited visibility. The kind of morning that would ground a sensible person. She climbed into the aircraft. Now here's where it gets interesting. She had no radio, no weather service in any meaningful modern sense, no backup navigation beyond a compass and whatever she could see out of the cockpit. Hamill had given her the compass heading and told her to follow the shipping lanes. The ships would be below her. If she could see the ships, she was on track. If she lost the ships in the fog, she was in trouble. She opened the throttle. The Blériot rolled across the grass and lifted into that gray English morning. And almost immediately, the fog closed in around her. No horizon, no sky, no sea, just the sound of the Gnome rotary spinning in front of her, the vibration through the wood and wire, and the compass needle pointing where she had to go. What she did in that moment is something every instrument-rated pilot will recognize, and every new student should think about carefully. She trusted her instruments, and she ignored what her body was telling her. This was before gyroscopic attitude indicators, before the tools we rely on. What she had was primitive by any modern standard. But she had the most important thing, which was the discipline to believe the compass over her own confused inner ear. At some point during the crossing, the fog thinned. She could see the water below, and she could see ships. She was over the shipping lane. She was on track. 59 minutes after leaving Dover, she descended through the gray over the French coast and landed in a field near Hardelot Plage, a small village on the Channel coast about 25 miles south of her intended destination at Calais. She had been pushed south by winds she couldn't see. But she was in France. She had crossed the Channel. She had done exactly what she said she would do. She climbed out of the Blériot in that purple suit on that French field, and the fishermen and farmers who came running to meet her had no idea what they were looking at. They had never seen anything like it. Neither had most of the world. But the world wasn't paying attention, because on the night of April 14th into April 15th, just 36 hours before Harriet Quimby touched down in France, the RMS Titanic had struck an iceberg in the North Atlantic. More than 1,500 people were dead. The ships were still searching. The telegraphs were still carrying the names of the lost. Every newspaper in England, France, and America had exactly one story that week. And it wasn't about a woman in a purple flying suit over the English Channel.
She got a few small notices. A paragraph here. A brief mention there. The aviation press was more generous, but even they understood the moment was swamped. One of the most significant achievements in early aviation, by any measure, and it landed in the historical record, like a stone thrown into water during a thunderstorm. Harriet Quimby came back to the United States and kept working. She flew at exhibitions. She wrote about aviation for Leslie's Illustrated Weekly, which had given her readers some of the most accessible coverage of the new flying age that any publication had produced. She demonstrated aircraft for manufacturers and appeared at meets up and down the East Coast. On July 1, 1912, she flew at the Harvard-Boston Aviation Meet at Squantum, Massachusetts.
She was carrying a passenger, a man named William Willard, the manager of the event. The flight started normally. At altitude, the aircraft suddenly pitched forward sharply and without warning. Whether it was a gust, a center of gravity problem, a mechanical failure, nobody was ever able to determine with certainty. In an era before seatbelts, when pilots and passengers sat in open cockpits without any restraint, the pitch threw both of them clear of the aircraft. The Bleriot, relieved of their weight, righted itself and glided down to a relatively normal landing on the beach. Harriet Quimby and William Willard fell into Dorchester Bay. Neither survived. She was 37 years old. She had held her pilot's certificate for less than 1 year. In that year, she became the first licensed American woman pilot. She became the first woman to fly the English Channel. She wrote some of the most important journalism produced about early aviation. She did all of it against the consistent low-level headwind of a world that kept expecting her to want less than she did, and she never once slowed down. What stays with me, every time I come back to her story, is the specific quality of that determination, the discipline to say no to Gustav Hamel's offer, not out of arrogance, but out of a clear-eyed understanding of what the attempt was actually for, the discipline to trust the compass over the body's instincts in that fog over the channel. These are not incidental qualities in a pilot, they are the whole thing, and she had them.
The United States Postal Service put her face on an airmail stamp in 1991, 80 years after she earned her certificate. There's a park in La Jolla, California with her name on it. The Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum has her in their permanent collection, including photographs of that purple satin suit. That's something. It's less than she deserved, but it's something. Much of what I know about Harriet Quimby comes from the National Air and Space Museum's collections and from the research of aviation historian Henry Serrano Villard. The Smithsonian Magazine has done some excellent work on her story. If you want to go deeper, find us at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger, Blue Skies.